Chapter 19. A Lover's Pinch. The stroke of death is as a lover's pinch, which hurts and is desired. Antony and Cleopatra, Act 5, Scene 2. When Cullen opens his eyes the next morning, Marin is staring back at him with a slightly worried frown. That's more than a little unusual. This is maybe the first time she's come up here in all the months she's worked for him. But his curiosity is a distant thing, someone else's emotion. He's aware that he should feel curious, or alarmed, or even annoyed, but last night has left him scoured bare. He can almost hear the wind-borne sand carving patiently away inside his chest. Even the anger and the fear are gone, leaving him as dead inside as the waste. "What happened?" he asks as he rolls out of bed, because that's what he would have asked yesterday morning. "Nothing, sir," she says, taking a hasty step back to clear his way as he goes for his clothes. His room is really too cold for standing around naked, but he stops anyway and looks at her. "Nothing?" Other words run through his mind, chief among them, "Then what are you doing up here?" But he doesn't say any of them. Yes, well, she licks her lips, more nervous than he's ever seen her, as she says, "Magister Pavis asked me to sit up here. He said you'd been ill in the night." Just as he knows he should feel something about her being in his room, he knows he should be amused by the thought of Dorian's reaction at being referred to as a magister. Cullen can almost hear him say, "Altus!" through gritted teeth, but that stirs up no more emotion than opening his eyes to Marin's frown. "I'm fine," Cullen tells her, and tolerates the doubtful look she gives him, because doing anything else would require him to actually feel something. He can't even feel embarrassed that he's standing naked in his bedroom in front of one of his subordinates. "I'll be down in a moment," he says, and she takes that for the dismissal it is. His clothes are on top of the chest, as if he hadn't tossed them in a pile last night, and he knows Dorian or Bull must have folded them because it's far too intimate a gesture for Marin. Everywhere he looks, he sees signs of their presence, or at least all the places where they carefully removed those signs. When he reaches his office, he finds all his papers spread over his desk, as if he didn't have to stack most of them up to get them out of Dorian's way last night. He almost questions his own memory, not until he shifts a few stacks and finds the marks Dorian's knife left in the wood of his desk, does he set at least some of those doubts aside. There are no signs of Bull at all. From the corner where she's been watching him since he descended the ladder, Marin asks, "Is something missing, sir?" He almost tells her yes, because it's bothering him that they've managed to erase themselves so effectively. The unease he feels, vague though it may be, is the first thing he's really felt since he woke up. As he slides a fingernail along one of the scratches on his desk, he adds, "When did Dorian leave?" She hasn't mentioned Bull even once, and Cullen suspects he left before she arrived. "Before dawn," she says, and her tone makes it plain that she thinks she's reassuring him. "Did he say where he was going?" "No, sir." His unease grows, almost piercing the gray fog. "Is there anything pressing I need to deal with this morning?" he asks, and when she shakes her head, he says, "I'll be back in a little while." The cold air reddens his ears and cheeks before he's halfway to Bull's room, the physical discomfort no more immediate than any of his emotions have been, as if the dead space inside him is seeping out into his skin. The metal handle of Bull's door is no colder than his fingers as he eases the door open gently. Bull is lying on his back on the bed, head turned toward Cullen, while Dorian sleeps across his chest. Even in sleep, Dorian is frowning, and there are lines at the corners of Bull's mouth. His eye patch is missing, the scar plainly visible for one of the few times since Cullen's known him. Cullen steps inside and shuts the door, but he doesn't move any closer. "Are you all right?" he asks stiffly. Both of you. Bull looks at him in silence for a moment.
Well enough. You?
All right, Cullen says. And he is, isn't he? The anger and the fear he's wanted to be rid of for years are finally gone. So he must be all right. He feels calm, the way he hasn't in months, maybe years. The same calm he imagines Bull feels all the time. Except there are those lines around Bull's mouth, and the fainter ones between his brows. On anyone else, Cullen would call it the beginning of a worried frown. He doesn't know what it means on Bull's face, just that his own calm is beginning to crack apart the longer he looks at it. I need to get back, Cullen says, and he can't seem to find a normal tone of voice. He might as well be talking to one of the endless parade of nobles Josephine insists on escorting through his office. Not a... whatever Bull is to him. Brother-in-arms? Friend? Lover? They've never defined their relationship. Cullen has actively resisted defining it, because any and all of those definitions come with expectations and responsibilities he doesn't want to deal with. For the first time, he realizes how brutally unfair that is, and he can almost hear his calm breaking apart. Until later, he says, in that same stiff voice, and escapes back onto the battlements before he loses control. There are no guards in sight, and Cullen can lean on the wall, sucking in deep breaths of cold air, unable to see anything except Bull's worried frown and Dorian's face tight with anxiety even in sleep. It turns out the hollow place in his chest is still capable of producing some emotion, and the shame that fills him now is as heavy and nauseating as the anger and the fear ever were. He did that, is doing that, to Dorian and to Bull. What kind of man is he that he'd lay this burden on anyone, much less two of the people who matter most to him? He doesn't want them to matter to him, doesn't want to matter to them in his turn. But what he wants has never had much impact on his reality. Coward, the demon whispers in his ear. If you were as brave as you pretend to be, you would stop torturing them like this. Corypheus. There's still Corypheus, and he won't leave his soldiers to face that terror with a leader too new to be trusted. Cullen takes one last deep breath and straightens his shoulders, heading for the stairs. Merrin will be waiting for him in his office, and he can't face her just yet. The garden should be relatively empty, so early in the day, and he can sit there until the memory of Bull's and Dorian's faces isn't quite so sharp. Except when he reaches the garden, he finds Mother Giselle standing before a small crowd, reciting from the Chant of Light. There's no peace to be found here, but Cullen pauses for a moment to listen to the story of the First Blight, even if it is a little too appropriate in their current circumstances. There in the depths of the earth they dwelled, spreading their taint as a plague, growing in number, until they were a multitude, and together they searched ever deeper, until they found their prize, their god, their betrayer. Cullen's mouth forms the words without conscious thought. These verses are every bit as much a part of him as the prayer he said before every battle, and they call up so many memories they might as well call up none at all. He learned the words by heart long before he left home, and then the Templars wrote them into his blood and his breath and his bones. He could recite most of this chapter of Threnodies without hesitating. It's been years since he thought about what any of it means, standing in the shadows watching the bowed heads in front of him. The last line burns deeper than it ever has. Their god, their betrayer. I have seen the throne of the gods, and it was empty. The Maker turned away from the world centuries ago. Even the Chantry acknowledges that. But where Mother Giselle and her sisters think they can lend their voices to Andraste's and somehow call him back, Cullen has set that hope aside. Their god has abandoned them. Betrayed them just as the old gods betrayed their priests. Cullen shakes himself and heads back the way he came, closing the door to the hallway gently once he's through. There are things that need doing, and he doesn't have time to wallow in self-pity. With the world unraveling around them, it's easy enough to avoid both Dorian and Bull over the next week, despite their attempts to catch him alone. There are so few places in Skyhold that don't see a constant stream of traffic these days, and Cullen becomes quite adept at spotting Bull's horns or the top of Dorian's staff before either of them can corner him. He knows it must hurt them, but he also knows it will be less painful for them in the long run. The memory of Dorian raging at him is barely an echo in the hollow place inside him, a hollowness Cullen welcomes now. Without the weight of fear and anger he's carried for so long, he can sleep without dreaming, and handle whatever new strangeness comes knocking at Skyhold's gate. That the fear and anger have taken every other emotion with them doesn't bother him. One way or another, he won't have to worry about it much longer. Corypheus's attack on Haven seems predictable, in hindsight. Listening to Leliana's scout describe the slaughter, it could hardly be called a battle. Cullen has a flash of his old rage, but it's gone before the tale is finished, and he's calm again when they begin to plan. With the army still making its way back from the Arbor Wilds, it doesn't take them long to work out the details of the only approach that has even a hope of success. They march for Haven before dawn, emptying Skyhold of every man and woman who can walk. There are children in the ranks, boys and girls younger than Cullen was when he became a Templar recruit. But he doesn't try to stop them. If Corypheus wins, their age won't protect them, and even the youngest maintain the quick march without complaint. As Cullen watches them, the rage flashes again, and again vanishes almost as soon as he identifies it. At least he no longer has to worry about avoiding anyone. Bull and Dorian are with the Inquisitor every minute of the trip, as the Inner Circle makes its own plans within the larger assault, for which Cullen is responsible. Bull catches his eye a few times, and once he looks up to find Dorian watching him intently. But for the most part, everyone's attention is fixed firmly on their destination. When Corypheus falls and the new breach closes, the only thing Cullen can feel is a detached relief, mixed in with an equally detached disappointment. By instinct, his face mirrors those around him, and he smiles and cheers and says all the right things. The trip back to Skyhold is less of a march and more of a disorganized ramble, but Cullen isn't about to take anyone to task for breaking rank. "We just saved the world," he explains patiently to one overeager lieutenant. "I doubt letting them have this moment counts as setting any sort of precedent." He doesn't bother pointing out that most of the soldiers around them picked up a sword for the first time less than 3 months ago. There's a reason they were left behind when the rest of the army marched on the Arbor Wilds. While they meander back to Skyhold, Josephine rides ahead to ensure the Inquisitor's return is greeted with the proper ceremony. Cullen wouldn't have thought it of himself, but for once he understands her. Corypheus is gone, and too many people stand ready to exploit the mess he's left behind. Without Fade Rifts and demons as a constant reminder, the Inquisition is vulnerable unless it can demonstrate its power before someone thinks to issue a challenge. If anyone could turn a meal into a weapon, or make the straggling return of a troop of children into something to inspire awe, it would be Josephine. So he doesn't begrudge the feasting and the shouting he's subjected to when they reach Skyhold, even as the noise sets up unpleasant vibrations in his chest. He stays to one side of the hall and nurses a drink through far too many iterations of the same conversation, waiting for the Inquisitor to retire so that he can excuse himself. It is possible, he discovers, to become bored with people congratulating him for his part in saving the world. If he could scrape up some actual pleasure or pride in the accomplishment, it might be different. But he can't, any more than he can find the anger that used to sustain him. Just before Cullen gives up waiting, the Inquisitor vanishes through the door beside the throne. No one else seems to notice, and Cullen has no doubt the celebration will continue unabated until at least dawn. But he can leave at last, his part in the pageantry finished. Done. He's done. The world drops into the hollow place in his chest and vanishes. He should feel triumph, or relief, or something more than the same heavy emptiness he's felt for the last week. But no matter how much he repeats the word, there are no echoes, just dead space that eats everything it touches and leaves more dead space behind.